Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bounds. To kick off the new year and a new decade, this week we're looking at what the cultural calendar has to offer in 2020 within the worlds of TV, film and art. From biennales to big dramas, our experts are here to fill you in on what you'll be getting an eyeful of over the coming months. And those experts are Karen Krasanovic, Scott Bryan and Francesca Gavin, all three of whom join me in the studio. Now, welcome to the programme. We've just had an exceptionally funny off-screen conversation about the farting in a film called The Lighthouse.
Yes.
Which Scott Bryan and Karen Krasanovic tell us is not played for laughs. I would say go rush now to the cinemas or the DVD vendor of your choice and go and see
for
The Lighthouse.
For some serious gas.
Very intensive as a film.
Yeah.
It's the kind of film that you don't get forgiven for taking people to. But this is, yes, for a minute there you think it's going to be a comedy, but you're just laughing inside and crying on the outside.
Definitely not for a date from the sounds of it.
Definitely. And that's like a reverse Pagliacci.
And it's also like a mystery thriller, which I won't spoil, but it's kind of the case that you're spending half the time being like, oh, I really want to work out what the mystery is. And then you work, then you get shown it at the end.
Okay.
And then I was like, oh God, I wish I never had seen it.
Can we mention that, two things?
Yep.
It's black and white.
Yeah.
And also it's got the most amazing sound design.
I've seen
it's
the
incredible.
It looks like a wonder. Bear that in mind, listeners, The Lighthouse, as I think recommended by Karen and Scott.
Probably. I'm not made up.
Around this table. That voice you can hear is that of Scott Bryan, and he's going to be filling us in about what's happening on the small screen next year. Scott, Mrs. America. Do you want me to introduce one of the characters?
Yes.
Real-life characters?
Yeah.
The mighty Cate Blanchett plays Phyllis Schlafly.
Yeah, so it's looking at the sort of Equal Rights Amendment, which kind of was like a movement against it, which kind of completely and dramatically changed the US political landscape pretty much to this date. And Cate Blanchett is directing it, and it's a mixture of portrayals between real people and fictional characters. And I think it shows how much change there's been in America in a very short space, but I think it also is there for primarily to sort of show how little has, but also in terms of like the religious right movement and the influence that has in terms of the conservative America. I think it's there to kind of show where it all stems from, because I think one of the great things about dramas is how it kind of allows us to have some sort of an understanding in terms of how we get into messes or how we get into political entrenchments or societal issues. And I think this is one of those dramas which kind of pinpoints how that episode happened and that implicates where we are now.
So Mrs. America seems to have an amazing, stellar, especially female cast, unsurprisingly. And Phyllis Schlafly was a real life, well, the opposite of a freedom fighter, I suppose. She was kind of like, in the UK we had Mary Whitehouse, who was certainly broadcasting rights, but a conservative. She's an arch conservative voice.
Yes.
And this is Cate Blanchett's character. I think I'm right in saying that 3/4 of the states of the United States have to vote in favour of the Equal Rights Amendment, and it's still never been passed. There's nothing in the American Constitution to say that women are equal to men.
No.
Women around the table, I was going to say roll
shaking
their eyes, but no one
heads.
No one is surprised that
well,
this
I'm
is the case.
I'm not deeply surprised.
No, indeed. And how's this look? How is this kind of, is this played for laughs? Is this a stylish piece of television?
From my understanding, because this is the really interesting thing about TV for next year, is you are given it in drips and drabs, pretty much through press releases, through tiny little teasers, but also at the moment, because you've got so many of the rivals who are really pitching themselves differently to each other, they love to withhold as much information because it essentially just gives it to their competitors. So with this, genuinely, and I've pestered them, is a few lines of a press release, a couple of stills, and maybe 2 or 3 short videos interspersed with a lot of others. But what's interesting is that this comes from FX, which of course is the same channel that created all of the successful Ryan Murphy shows. Ryan Murphy himself has been sort of picked up by Netflix. And I think that there is a certain interest from the same channel that brought you The People versus OJ Simpson of having that kind of authenticity, because that's what makes that channel stand out in the US.
And FX was originally like the science fiction channel, wasn't it? Kind of, and it's a 20th Century Fox kind of.
Well, now we're going into media ownership, because of course they've all been bought by each other, haven't they?
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's different.
It's part
now.
Of the soup.
It's part of the soup.
It's one of the letters in the alphabet soup that make up the great world of the brave new world of television that we live in. So that is Mrs. America. That is out beginning of next year-ish.
Yeah, again, we don't know because they don't tell us. But we know it's going to be in FX first. BBC have a deal with FX with all of their current programming. So I would imagine it would be appearing in the UK, and normally it's about 3 or 4 months after it airs in the US.
I'm expecting some good speeches in this and some sort of some powerful roles in this TV show.
I would expect to.
Next up, and I've simply written as my comment next to the title, cough, is quiz coming soon to ITV here in the UK. Just before Scott explains this one, the coughing major on ITV's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, one of my favourite sort of pop culture news stories ever. Do you remember this?
No.
He was accused of, well, Scott's going to fill us in. Who needs me here? Do you remember him?
Yes,
remember
anyway, this? I'm not going to spoil that.
So Charles Ingram, who was accused along with Terence Whitlock of basically coughing. Charles was a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and he was being guided by the coughs from an audience member. Yeah. And it ended up being a big court case. He was never awarded the million. And there was ended up being a documentary about it, because they never really showed the full episode because they kind of had a sense that something was not going right. And that documentary was watched by 13 million people at the time. It was a huge sensation. There was a court case involved. And now, in a really rather meta way, James Graham, who, of course, is a playwright, he also did the Brexit drama starring Benedict Cumberbatch that was on TV just over a year and a half ago, has now made a TV adaptation of his play for television on the same channel where the incident had occurred on ITV.
It's great.
So meta.
It's great. And it stars Michael Sheen as Chris Tarrant. And I got sent a press shot, and it is so spot on, a light, like look-alike.
Holly's showing us a picture of Michael Sheen as Chris Tarrant through the studio glass.
I mean, it's terrifying, and I would never have thought they would look so alike.
It's so good. Michael Sheen is so good at that sort of role,
This is where a casting agent or casting director is so important, because they have to work with researchers, makeup, hair, lighting, wardrobe, to bring us that immediacy and to get it right. And that's an incredible match.
It really is. It really is. And I think it'll be a real interest, because Michael Sheen is also an actor who's managed to be so versatile that every time he plays somebody like David Frost, he was David Frost.
Yeah, yes. Brilliant in that.
And there's something weirdly Frostian and Blairish about Chris Tarrant. I mean, that's kind of Tarrant. That's Blair with blonde hair, isn't it?
Permanent. I mean, it's the 90s. Yeah. The 90s are, I mean, obviously with the weird Friends revival that's happening culturally at the moment, which freaks me out. People are into the 90s, so I've just seen a lot of
You can't say something like that as a throwaway item, Francesca. Scott's got so much to say on that. We simply don't have the time.
I'm at the edge of my seat.
I literally can't wait for this.
Oh, same here. And it's also directed by Stephen Frears.
That says it all. That's all you needed to say.
Scandal, the Queen.
I love a bit of Frears.
You can be uneven, but yes, for the most part, he's pretty good. This reminds me of Quiz Show, the Ralph Fiennes and the set in America, the same sort of thing. And we love that kind of stuff because we figure it's all rigged anyway.
There's a real trend at the moment of dramatization of news stories or things that have happened. And this is just that craving for as much authenticity as physically possible when it comes into how things look. And people really love it.
You know what really irks me is when I see a great movie and it's based on an article in Esquire.
Yeah. I need to get into talks. I'm sure we can turn some of these expos that we've been doing for years into a We need to change how this works. This is okay. We've got time for two quick extra televisual mentions, and they're both about Russian spying and murdering people.
Yeah. So the first
outside
one
outside of Russian soil.
Yeah. So the first one is Salisbury, which looks at the poisoning of Sergei and Yulia Skripal. I think the interest for me is, in many different forms, it's kind of the case that, this was a unexpected and huge international incident that happened on a small, quiet, sleepy Wiltshire city. And I'm from Salisbury. So it was kind of like seeing this really rather surreal thing happening in an area that you really know. But then it's also been the case that once, you had the backlash from, Russian disinformation networks, you had the involvement of, the intelligence services, you had a huge cleanup operation on the street that lasted many weeks and months. But then it all went away. Mm. And I think that Salisbury has unfortunately had to deal with a lot of the consequences for a long time. It's really hurt the local economy. Of course, there was also the two people several months later, one of which who sadly passed away because of an unconnected event related to the poisoning. So it's kind of, this drama is trying to, I think, have a look at that, look at how the community have tried to move on from that situation. But I am also intrigued to see what will the reaction from this drama be, because of course you've seen at a international level Russia very much be against what the British have been saying happened on this event, and you wonder whether that, for the Russian perspective, is just going to add more fuel onto the fire.
It's a strange other sort of Chernobyl TV story where there's you know, it's like there'll be another Salisbury made in a studio in Russia.
So yeah, yeah. Honest. I mean, you've seen this before, you know, in yeah. terms of like they either discredit it or they try to create their own version of it. And it's mm-hmm. really interesting how drama can be used like a political weapon.
Absolutely. Kind
of... Oh, yeah. I mean, I read an article about the weaponization of drama in these regards. I felt for Salisbury because it's such a beautiful city. And it's the first time I've ever seen Stonehenge made out of fudge.
There's two reasons to love Stonehenge there, I think.
I always think of also the Itsu on Piccadilly where the first polonium poisoning was, yeah. which was closed and now is open. And I've eaten there and it survived. So people, like, the Itsu's still there.
Yeah.
People are still nibbling. So I would imagine if Itsu's an example for Salisbury, it's going to be okay in the long run. But yeah. I mean, that's a very yeah. specific reference.
Salisbury will still be there.
I don't think the Woking Pizza Express will ever recover, but yeah.
Well said. Plot Against America in very short order. Scott, what can you tell us about this one?
Yes,
this is
so
similar,
it's a
kind of vibe.
Very similar vibe. So it's a HBO adaptation of the novel by Philip Roth, and it looks at what might have happened if Charles Lindbergh had actually won the election instead of Roosevelt. You know, Charles Lindbergh was associated apparently with being quite far right, you know, a lot of appeasement towards Hitler and Germany. So it kind of gives this idea about whether there was a possibility of America falling into a fascist state. And of course, there's always that interest about how much of it is a parallel towards what's happening now in an international way.
So that is The Plot Against America. That's on HBO. And Salisbury will be coming to the BBC. And Scott's larger picks were Mrs. America on FX and Quiz, starring the coughing major Charles Ingram, on ITV. Scott, thank you very much indeed for dipping our toes, all of our toes, in the waters of 2020's televisual feasts. Francesca Gavin is going to hit us over the head with 2020's art picks. An unusual one first.
Yes.
Carl Craig.
I know. This is why I picked it. I mean, I was really interested in this and the idea of the recontextualization of popular culture in like a serious space. So Carl Craig, huge techno DJ from Detroit, one of like the big originals. And he's doing a sound installation at Deer Beacon, which is seriously respected upstate New York art institution with a great heritage. And he's drawing on this kind of ideas of euphoria and references to clubs like Berghain, where the lights come in and out. Like shutters come on and off, which is, if you've ever been to Berghain, which I have luckily, is one of the experiences you get within them. But also this club called Yellow in Tokyo. But it's a really, the idea of him being placed in a serious context, I think, is really important. In the same way that someone like Charlie Mingus is being reconsidered as like a serious composer, I think it's a, like a continuation of that kind of reconsideration of African-American culture as something serious and worthy of attention alongside straight white men.
Does this kind of sit in a similar space to Mark Leckie's thing at the Tate?
I think this is going to be closer to like sound installation work.
Okay.
So it's much more like about immersive spaces, because I mean, that's obviously what Carl's used to working with. He's a musician and he creates electronic music and is conscious about our awareness of space. So I think it's going to be close to, let's say, something like things like Random International, that kind of immersive mm-hmm. entry, or someone like Susan Phillips, who's making sound pieces where you're moving around a space and you reconsider it completely through the use of sound and light.
How comfortable is the art world discourse, our critics and curators, with this new wash of reconsidering people that kind of do something different for a job?
I mean,
and now they're being put into art spaces. Does that go down as easily as we're talking about it today?
I think so. And I think having someone like Dia do something like this is really, I mean, it's part of also the extension of one of the other things I was going to mention, which is Betty Sayre, who's won the Wolfgang Hahn Prize and showing in Museum Ludwig in Germany. This kind of re-examination of the canon to incorporate women and people of color and basically change the way we review history. So this whole wave of, I love an old lady, the rise of
yes.
the old lady artist.
I was going to ask you about that with yeah. reference to Betty Sayre. Yeah,
one of my favorite artists. But this is yeah. a perfect example that, again, I'd seen her work popping up through small like group shows in LA. She's making work throughout the 60s and 70s that was reappropriating racist objects and basically from a different perspective, or incorporating quite weird supernatural esoteric stuff and old photographs. Really incredible work. And then she was given a Fondazione Prada show. And from then, career went like that, huge. So I think Carl Craig, in a similar way, him being doing something at Dia means that an entire serious world starts looking at him going, oh, he's happy to be working in a different context. I love things when it crosses context.
Yeah.
So much fun.
And I wasn't hugely familiar with Betty Sayre's work either, but that's kind of some of that imagery. It's amazing.
I mean,
and
I traveled to Milan to see it. It's so incredible. She's always been plugging away and she's really, let's say, made it in a much more international way in her 80s. And I think that's just incredible. The the work's super powerful. It's really interesting. It's very personal. She has her own language and what she does. She was always making work, and she had like some recognition within that, particularly that community, particularly in Los Angeles, over a long period of time. She's always been plugging away, but now it's really much more of an international perspective. She was one of the big hits out of Soul of the Nation that was traveling from the Tate over to LA and New York, the big...
It must be funny suddenly coming to sort of public prominence when you're like in your late 70s.
Better late than never.
Better late than never, but you kind of think, oh, well, that's a shame. She would have loved all that international air travel in her sort of 30s.
I mean, like, listen, I'm also a great believer in, like, why should someone who's 25 have something really interesting to say about life or the world? They haven't lived enough. Maybe you need some good decades. You can be emerging in your 50s if you're an artist, in my opinion.
So that's Carl Craik at Deer Beacon. I like the idea of something that doesn't need to have a big kind of opening night rave up, because it is one.
Well, he is going to be doing performances as well. And also the industrial heritage of Detroit techno is really interesting in an institution that takes place in a former Nabisco packaging factory.
Yeah.
So there's a real relationship between like monumental, big, giant modernist art, like Richard Serra vibe, and then Carl Craig. I like that. I think it makes a lot of sense in the context.
Makes a lot of sense in that, in that particular space as well. So Carl Craig, possibly well at home at Deer Bacon. An ode to a breakfast. Deer Beacon, that starts on March the 6th. Betty Saar's at the Museum Ludwig in Cologne, and that's on from April the 22nd. But, Francesca, tell us about your mushroom show.
I mean, I can't help it. This is totally and utterly me plugging myself.
That's all right. You've got the full backing of us three around the table.
It's my main focus of 2020, so it makes sense. I am curating an exhibition called Mushrooms, the Art, Design and Future of Fungi, which opens at Somerset House on the 31st of January. And it runs over 3 months, and there's lots of mushroom events and mushroom food and mushroom talks and an incredible breadth of work, particularly largely over the past 50 years, but everything from Beatrix Potter to Karsten Holler to Kashi Murakami to John Cage, tons of emerging artists, shoes, bricks, everything made out of mushrooms. Pentagram have designed it. They've made a crazy algorithmic typeface that grew like a mushroom. There's lots of mushroom facts.
There's a whole shop of mushrooms. A mushroom shop.
Of this. I mean, I go immediately, I think Dubuffet, but then I think, no, it's a tree. It's not a mushroom. Where did the genesis, the idea?
Where did the idea come from? I'm a journalistic curator. You know, you just keep seeing them everywhere. I mean, admittedly, it's probably because my sister is my muse and she makes a lot of collage work with mushrooms in it. And then I just started noticing it everywhere. And the craze is huge at the moment. It's literally like, if you go through art history and you pick an artist, Sigmar Poker, mushroom, you'll find something. Wallace Berman, there's a mushroom picture.
I think there are mushrooms in Bosch.
Actually a bit of a shift though, because if you look at the medieval reference to the mushroom, it was often seen as something disgusting and kind of evil and kind of rotting. It was only really in like the mid-19th century, at least in a Western European as opposed to a Russian European, they have a different relationship with mushrooms. It was only in that kind of amateur botany period that people began to accept mushrooms as nicer, and then you particularly have Alice in Wonderland, so we have a whole bunch of Alice in Wonderland books and that kind of
and that whole psychedelic side of it as well,
which is enormous, but also I think that's the main reason why people are so interested in mushrooms now. Michael Pollan and that whole wave of like serious scientific examination of fungi as something that's positive in our relationship and coexistence with humanity, because that's the main thing. It's like, we can't live without mushrooms. They're in our body, they're part of our microbiome. Like, plants can't live without mushrooms. A lot of trees get their nutrients because of mycelium. So I think it's a really nice metaphor for our relationship, perhaps politically in a wider sense about coexistence, but maybe even more specifically with nature and how we need to learn how to live with nature in order to survive.
A tiny part of me doesn't trust something that kind of grows quite big overnight when it wasn't there the previous evening.
But think of it like a flower, because actually it's much scarier what a mushroom is because it's the weird stuff underground. The biggest organism in the world is 3,000-hectare mushroom in the north of Oregon that's between 2,500 and 8,000 years old. Like, it's a giant mushroom. I find that all these things
are
super fascinating. They tried to drill into it. They wanted to build on top of it, and they realized there's something a bit wrong with the ground here.
Wow.
And it's a giant mushroom.
This is very, because we're somewhere between Stranger Things and one of possibly one of Karen's choices
yeah.
in 2020's films. Francesca, congratulations in advance to the
show. Thank you.
We might be mentioning that, I think, probably on Culture in January anyway.
Oh, that's something exciting.
I really
want
to go.
It's at Somerset House from 31st January?
From 31st January. Okay. It runs until April. There's loads of things. And it's free, which I thought was very important.
Thank you.
I love free things.
We don't really have time to mention the Riga Biennial in May, other than to say that...
It's really good. Yeah. Rebecca Lamarche-Fidel's curating it. It's really good. Go to Riga. I think it's going to be the best biennial this year, even though Manifesto 13 is always interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about Riga. Riboca. Okay. R-I-B-O-C-A-2.
Francesca Gavin, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
For talking us so instructionally through things so quickly, too. Last, but obviously not least, it's Karen Krasanovich.
I just want to hear more of them.
More mushroom stuff.
I know all my stuff. I want to hear more about you.
People will be chomping at the bit, though, to hear some filmic recommendations for 2020. Karen, what is up your sleeve?
It's so hard to decide because the Oscars are coming and the Golden Globe nominations have already been out.
Uh-huh.
And there's so many good films in the cinema in January that if you haven't seen them and you want to pretend that you can make judgments at the Oscar...
Important to be able to shout at the TV.
It's really important to lie convincingly that you've seen the film and you know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm here to help you. But it's a plethora. I don't even know where to start. So
should we start with Jojo Rabbit?
We'll start with Jojo Rabbit and The Gentleman. I will concentrate on those two.
Okay.
Because they're popular and people are asking about them. So Jojo Rabbit, everybody knows Taika Waititi's comedy background.
Uh-huh.
He did What We Do in the Shadows and The Curse of the Were People. I've seen it. I still can't say the title. And we know him because he's New Zealand's answer to, I don't know, Monty Python All Rolled into One. He's serious. He's a director. He's a writer. And he's made a very questionable, contentious, controversial movie called Jojo Rabbit, which is where he plays a fantasy comedy Hitler.
Oh, so he's playing the Hitler.
He is Hitler. And when he first appears, you think, oh, it's a comedy Hitler. Now, we've seen comedy Hitlers before, Charlie Chaplin and Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Everybody tries to do it. And I was reading where some Holocaust survivors had seen this movie and saying, well, you know, I think children might actually think that this is what Nazi Germany was like. It was just all fun and games.
It was accidental explosions, not real ones.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so it's one of these films that you just think, am I going to laugh or am I going to cry? Were you going to do both? It looks amazing. The cinematography, the production design, the pace, the sound design, everything is wonderful. And I'm just going to say one name to you, and you will go. Sam Rockwell.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Good old Sam Rockwell.
And it's got a lot of surprises. I don't actually want to tell you too much about it. We've got Rebel Wilson, who shows you what it was like to be a woman in part of the Nazi youth. She goes, I've had children for Hitler. That's all she gets to do. But there's a lot of knife throwing and bomb throwing. And
it's got a sort of, as unwhimsical as its topic, as its subject is, it's got a bit of a Wes Anderson about it. There's a sort of lot of craft to the scenery, the costumes, hair, makeup, set design, etc. It's quite a beautiful looking thing.
If you take away Wes Anderson's seriousness, sometimes Wes Anderson can be quite cloying. You feel kind of...
Yeah.
You know? But this one, you'll sit back and you'll think, well, I saw it the first time and I thought, oh, it's not that good. I really enjoyed the way it looked. And then the second time, I was weeping into my sock.
I mean, I love We Live in the Shadows. It's the funniest thing
it's wonderful.
That's ever existed.
It has that, but he's moving forward. All comic writers have to go into drama because they have gone past drama to get to comedy. They're coming back. So if you're going to see one film for January, do see that one.
Here's Master Jojo. You're our top man. Prepare to leave the house.
Today you boys will be involved in such activities as war games, ambush techniques, Zimbabwe stuff up.
I don't think I can do this.
Okay, that was a little clip of Jojo Rabbit, directed by Taika Waititi, who also plays... It's this child's sort of pretend best friend, isn't it?
It's
his invisible friend.
Yeah, but he's people come up to him and says, who did I see you talking with? Oh, nobody. He actually talks to Hitler. We can see him. And Hitler does crazy things. I don't want to ruin it too much for you, but I'm not going to tell you what happened. But there were really surprising visual elements in this. And also, as the child's awareness grows, the fantasy Hitler also changes.
So
that's interesting.
So are we saying a subtle... Not subtle.
It's not subtle.
Okay. Jojo
that's
Rabbit.
What's fun about it.
Jojo Rabbit, funny. And might make you scratch your head.
Yeah, it will. Bring a hanky, though.
Okay. Well, you used a sock. I don't know. Did you take it off your foot and then dry your eyes?
I had a gym kit with me.
Okay.
An old, sweaty sock.
Got a weird window into the screening life of Karen Krasinovich.
Before the gym.
Before the gym. Okay. The gentleman was also...
Okay.
...was very keen to come out. Shall we have a little clip of the gentleman?
I want you to play a game with me, Ray.
I don't want to play a game.
Oh, please.
No.
I said play a game with me, Ray.
Right.
Lovely. I want you to imagine a character. Your boss, Mickey Pearson.
You're too smart to be blackmailing us, Fletcher.
Okay, that is a clip from Guy Ritchie's upcoming film called
Can you
Gentlemen. Well, let's see if Francesca and Scott can guess who that was.
Hugh Grant.
Wow,
very well, it was Hugh Grant doing Mockney.
It's quite a change from Paddington 2, isn't it?
It's great. No, I think this is carrying on from Knives Out, where we're giving artists that we know really, really well these really lovely roles that they would have never had.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's jumped for it.
Sounding a bit like Ben Kingsley's kind of difficult to pronounce gangster in Sexy Beast as well.
Sir Ben. Don't forget.
Sorry, Sir Ben.
He doesn't like it.
Well, on his monogrammed pyjamas, do you think it says SBK?
Definitely.
Okay. 100%.
All right. I thought so.
Anyway, okay. So, okay. Aladdin. Guy Ritchie's coming off of this mega remake of, controversial remake of Disney's Aladdin, which I loved. Yeah. I thought Will Smith was just as good as Robin Williams, but it's a different guy. But I loved it, and I'm the only one in the world that really loved it. So, but right after that huge thing, he was working on The Gentlemen. Now, we've all been, you know, thinking, oh, Guy Ritchie's lost his mojo. Well, no, he hasn't. In fact, he's got a new one. It's a terrific ensemble of gangland warfare over Matthew McConaughey's vast weed farms, which he now has... As a Rhodes Scholar, he now has upper crust sort of delivery contacts.
Okay.
So he's got great product and a great distribution service. He's trying to sell it to Jeremy Strong. Everybody loves him.
Everyone loves Jeremy Strong, yeah.
Exactly. Now, of course, when there's money and do you know a drug deal that's ever said, yeah, here, have the money, here, have it? No, it's got to be complicated. So we not only get a Hugh Grant as a filthy, horrible journalist, detective journalist, trying to blackmail Charlie Hunnam, who is Matthew McConaughey's right-hand man, into making a decision and selling him. I mean, it's too complicated. We've got Michelle Dockery as tough as her husband, Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
We've also got Colin Farrell, again, really surprising in a role. He's a boxing coach of a group of boxers who wear matching tweed shell suits, and they're called the Toddlers. And when they go and they commit a crime, they also make a music video of the crime. And it's really good.
So there's an amazing cast already. There's some wonderful people.
Huge. But they're also Henry Golding. And it's just, I think Jason Wong's in it as well. Everybody gets even time. And it's a terrific story. It's funny. It's spacey. But it's also a big advertisement for Guy Ritchie's brewery and for his bar.
Does he have a weed
his
farm?
Pub. He might. Gosh. Blew my mind. I bet he does.
Is it a thinly disguised campaign for the legalization of cannabis?
Jeez, I'm so gullible. I just missed that.
I mean, I know someone who's become a millionaire from all of that, from CBD industry alone, but actually with the legal weed as well. It's being publicly traded on the American stock market now.
This does come in where we said this is going to go legal and it's going to go mega.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, my local pub is Guy Ritchie's pub, Lore of the Land, which is in Fitzrovia. And also he has designed a barbecue, which we see in the movie, that he's going to launch, apparently, reportedly, at the Chelsea Flower Show this year.
Wowee.
Keep away from flowers.
Wheels within weird wheels within smoke
but
rings.
But it's great. It's a terrific film. It's lots of fun.
Yeah.
And it's Guy Ritchie back to form, and he is our Tarantino.
Good old Guy back on form with The Gentleman. Before that, Karen was talking about Jojo Rabbit by Taika Waititi. We've got 2 minutes to talk about two last-minute little things. Parasite.
Right. Parasite, the big, big Oscar hopes for Bong Joon-ho. Everybody loves him since he's done The Host, Snowpiercer, Okja. It deserves all the accolades it's getting because it is so emotional and it's so deft and it's so timely. It's about an unemployed family who take take an interest in the wealthy and glamorous parks for their livelihood. So this way I'm trying to really make it very clear. It's a family that's very complicated. They're all impoverished, and the different ways that they do that they manage to survive. But it's a look at people on the fringes, and also the emotional life and the health of them. And it's poignant, it's funny, it's surprising, it's incredibly smart, and people love this film. And it's going to be released, I believe it's February the 7th. So please go and see it.
That is Parasite. We've got 30 seconds to try to do some vague justice to Cunningham.
Cunningham. Merce Cunningham. I hope it's Merce. It's not Mercy Cunningham. It's Merce Cunningham.
Yeah.
It's a 3D film about the legendary American choreographer. Wow. And I think that's going to be just really, even if it's no good, I think it's going to be really
interesting.
It's going
to look beautiful.
See. Yeah. You're going to be sitting there with those glasses thinking, wow.
Wow.
Well, I mean, the amazing...
Getting some Pina Bausch kind of vibes.
Exactly.
Off that.
Yeah. That's
those
what I
shows
thinking.
That look good but aren't good. There's some real joy in them.
You know, there is, because filmmaking is so hard. Being creative is so hard. And at the end of the day, what you see and what you enjoy, it's your version of it. So enjoy.
That's very beautifully said. I think that's the way to
end
the
program.
That brings us to the end of this week's show. Thank you to my guests, Scott Bryan, Francesca Gavin and Karen Krasanovic. And of course to my producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.